Welcome to the Deep Dive. Our whole mission here is to cut through all the noise, give you insights that really matter, and turn these sometimes complex topics into clear, actionable knowledge. So today, I want you to picture something you will encounter in your clinical practice. Imagine you're on the ward. Maybe it's quiet. Maybe it's the middle of a hectic emergency, and you're observing a patient. Maybe they seem withdrawn, gaze is distant, like they're not fully present. Or maybe they're agitated, reacting really strongly to something that seems, well, minor. What's going on beneath the surface? What unseen history is quietly shaping how they interact, how they react to you, to everything? Today, we are diving deep into the profound, often invisible impact of trauma and the stress-related disorders that can unfortunately stem from it. This deep dive is all about understanding acute stress disorder, PTSD, and dissociative disorders.
Absolutely. And this deep dive, it's really custom tailored for you, especially as nursing students getting ready for the front lines of healthcare. Our mission today is specific. We want to equip you with essential knowledge, knowledge that won't just serve you in clinical practice, but will fundamentally shape how you see and care for your patients. We're aiming for a clear, comprehensive understanding of these conditions, focusing not just on, you know, the clinical symptoms and how common they are, but really, most critically, on the priority nursing assessments and interventions. Because that's the knowledge that empowers you. It lets you provide truly informed, safe, and deeply compassionate care.
Yeah, and we've really dug into a lot of material for this. Detailed instructor notes, study guides, lecture overviews, the works. We've distilled it all down. The goal is that what you take away from this chat is thorough, practical, and something you can use right away. And let me tell you, as you prepare for your roles as nurses, this isn't just academic stuff. It's absolutely vital. These disorders, they're incredibly common, they're complex, and they demand a nuanced, deeply empathetic approach from every single one of us in healthcare. Understanding them isn't just ticking a box. It's about providing care that sees the patient, cares for their whole being, and genuinely helps them heal. Okay, let's unpack this. So to really build a solid foundation here, let's start with what seems like a simple question, but clinically, it's anything but. What exactly is trauma? It's a word we hear a lot, sometimes thrown around casually. But for us as nurses, it has this profound, specific meaning. What are the nuances we need to grasp? Is it just any upsetting event, or is there a clinical line?
That's a great place to start, because getting trauma right is foundational. Our sources make it clear. Clinically, trauma isn't just any upsetting thing that happens. It typically refers to experiences involving a significant threat or actual harm. We generally break it down into two main areas. First, there's physical trauma. That's often what jumps to mind first, right? Think serious injury, a direct physical attack, a bad car accident leaving visible wounds. It's the kind of trauma we can often see measure objectively.
Okay, the visible stuff. Makes sense.
But then there's psychological trauma. And this is equally, maybe even more impactful, and often much less visible. Yet the wounds can run incredibly deep. This involves exposure to actual death or threatened death, serious injury, or sexual violence. It's not just the direct physical hit, but the profound psychological shockwave it sends out. Imagine witnessing something horrific, like a mass casualty scene, or experiencing a direct threat to your life or someone you love. The event itself might be over fast, but the brain's processing of that threat, that can leave a lasting imprint. It's really an assault on your sense of safety, your sense of control, the basic belief that the world is somewhat predictable.
Right, so it's not always a physical wound. It can be this invisible attack on your fundamental sense of safety.
Yep.
And critically, it isn't always a single sudden thing, is it? We often think of trauma like a big bang, but the sources suggest it can be sneakier.
Exactly. That's a crucial point, especially for you as nursing students. What's vital to get is that trauma isn't always one isolated incident that happens and then it's over. Our sources really emphasize that trauma can actually develop over time from various internal and external factors. It underscores how complex and multifaceted it truly is. Think of it less like a single lightning strike and sometimes more like a slow erosion, a constant drip of ongoing stress, or a series of really challenging or abusive events that over time just wear down a person's psychological defenses, their ability to cope.
Oh, right.
So for you as nursing students, this means looking beyond just the immediate problem someone presents with. You need to consider their whole life context, their history of adversity. Understand that what you're seeing today might be the cumulative effect of years of struggle. It speaks to human endurance, sure, but also vulnerability when pushed repeatedly.
That deeper understanding really shifts the perspective. And it opens up another really important idea, one that offers some hope. Resilience. We know not everyone who goes through something traumatic gets emotionally injured or develops a disorder. Why is that? What role does resilience play here?
Resilience is a truly powerful concept. It's a testament to our human capacity for adaptation. We define it pretty simply as the capacity to withstand stress and catastrophe. It's that inherent strength, or often a developed capacity, that lets someone not just survive, but adapt, recover, maybe even grow or thrive when faced with really profound adversity. And this is exactly why not everyone who experiences trauma develops PTSD or another related disorder. How people respond is influenced significantly by a whole host of factors, but crucially by the coping mechanisms they've built up and refined from past experiences. It's like building a strong immune system for your mind, for your spirit. Some people just come into a traumatic event with a more robust set of these psychological tools, or they develop them incredibly quickly afterwards.
Ah, okay. So it's not just about what happened to them, but also about the internal resources, the strengths they've built up within themselves over their life. That's a huge hopeful point. But how do we as nurses spot that?
Yeah.
And maybe even help foster in somebody who's really struggling right now.
Absolutely. And for you as nursing students, this insight is incredibly valuable clinically and personally. It means when you're assessing a patient, you need to understand their history beyond just the immediate trauma. You're actively looking for their inherent strengths, their past coping strategies. What resources, internal, external, have they used successfully before? Did they overcome a tough childhood, navigate a difficult career change? Were they a caregiver? These aren't just biographical details, they're clues, indicators of their capacity to problem solve, endure, adapt. By identifying these past successes, you can tap into and promote their existing resilience, help them see their own capabilities instead of just focusing on the problems. It's about reminding them and ourselves that even in the darkest moments, people bring incredible, often overlooked strengths. It shifts our approach from just treating pathology to actively building on inherent strengths.
That makes perfect sense. A really positive way to frame care. Okay, with that foundation, let's move into the specific disorders. Starting with what often happens right after a deeply distressing event, acute stress disorder, or ASD. How do we define this, and what's the absolute key thing that sets it apart?
Acute stress disorder, ASD. It's exactly what it sounds like, an intense but short-term disorder directly linked to experiencing or witnessing a major traumatic event. The crucial diagnostic difference here, and this is something you really need to remember, is the timeline. It's very tight. The symptoms must occur within 1 month of the traumatic event, and just as critically, they must persist for less than 1 month. That time frame is the absolute key for diagnosing ASD. It's what separates it from other stress disorders, especially PTSD.
Less than 1 month. Got it.
If the symptoms last longer, the diagnosis changes.
So it's this very acute, almost immediate, intense reaction. What do those symptoms actually look like for someone going through ASD? What would we see as nurses?
The symptoms of ASD often look like what we'd expect from severe, overwhelming stress, but they're specifically tied to that traumatic event. First, people often have intrusive memories. The event just keeps replaying in their mind, uninvited and distressing. These could be vivid mental pictures, thoughts, even sensory flashbacks, maybe not as intense as in PTSD, but definitely upsetting.
Like images just popping into their head.
Exactly. Imagine a patient from a serious car accident suddenly seeing images of the crash flash before their eyes during a quiet moment, or hearing the screech of tires when there is no car nearby. Second, they'll often show avoidance behaviors. They're actively trying to stay away from anything that reminds them of the trauma. This could look like avoiding conversations about it, refusing to watch news about similar events, or even physically avoiding the place where it happened.
So they might seem withdrawn.
Yes, you might see them withdrawing socially or quickly changing the subject if the event comes up. It's their mind desperately trying to escape those painful reminders. Third, a heightened state of hyperarousal is really common. Their nervous system is basically step in overdrive. They might be constantly on edge, jump really easily at sudden noises or movements, or just find it impossible to relax. They might say they feel jumpy or wired. This constant vigilance is exhausting.
Yeah, I can imagine.
And finally, a very common and debilitating symptom is significant sleep disturbances. The intrusive thoughts, the anxiety, the hyperarousal, it all makes it incredibly hard to fall asleep, stay asleep, or get restful sleep. They might have nightmares or just feel like they can't shut their mind off. This leads to serious fatigue, which then makes all the other symptoms feel even worse.
Wow, that sounds incredibly distressing. Constantly reliving it, desperately trying to avoid it, and never getting proper rest.
Mm-hmm.
It really shows how trauma isn't just mental, it hits your whole body. Is there a biological reason for this immediate intense reaction? Or is it purely psychological?
Oh, there absolutely is. And understanding this biological link is critical. It helps us move past thinking these things are just in their head. Our sources strongly suggest that a possible dysregulation of the hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis, or HPA axis, is the physiological basis for the link between trauma and developing ASD.
The HPA axis. Remind us quickly.
Sure. Simply put, the HPA axis is your body's central stress response system. It's what kicks in when you sense danger, releasing stress hormones like cortisol to get you ready for fight or flight. When this system gets dysregulated after trauma, it basically means your body is stuck in this overactive stress mode. It's like the on switch for your internal alarm system is jammed. It's constantly signaling danger, even when there's no immediate threat. And that leads to the persistent hyperarousal, the trouble relaxing, the physical symptoms of anxiety.
Okay.
So it's not just psychological, it's a profound biological shift, a rewiring of the body's own protective systems. That demands our clinical attention and helps us understand just how deep their suffering goes. It also explains why things like relaxation techniques can be so hard for these patients. At first, their body is literally fighting against being calm.
That's a really important distinction. The body's alarm is literally stuck on high. Now, you mentioned the crucial time frame for ASD, less than 1 month. What happens if these symptoms, the intrusive memories, the avoidance, hyperarousal, sleep problems, what if they continue past that 1 month mark? Does the diagnosis just vanish or change?
It absolutely changes. And this is a critical diagnostic threshold for you to lock in as nursing students. If those symptoms characteristic of acute stress disorder go on for longer than 1 month, then the diagnosis typically shifts from ASD to post-traumatic stress disorder, or PTSD.
Okay. ASD becomes PTSD after a month.
Right. And that shift really underscores why ongoing assessment is so vital. Mm-hmm. You need to understand the natural, often evolving course of these disorders. It's not a one-time check. It's about continuous monitoring, adapting your care plan as the patient's presentation and needs change. Think of an ASD diagnosis as a kind of warning sign. It flags someone at high risk for developing PTSD, making early intervention and support even more critical.
So PTSD is essentially a more persistent, longer-term version of those intense stress symptoms. Can you elaborate a bit on its definition and scope? What makes it stick around?
Absolutely. Post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD, happens precisely when those profound stress symptoms from trauma persist for more than 1 month. And what's critically important to understand about PTSD, something I really want to emphasize, is that it does not discriminate. It doesn't care about age, culture, socioeconomic status, background, none of that. It can develop any time across the lifespan, from childhood experiences right through to events in old age. A significant cause highlighted in our sources, which has particularly severe and often lifelong effects, is military violence. Think about the cumulative weight of repeated combat exposure. For older adults, especially veterans, these piled up trauma memories can lead to lifelong struggles. They often intensify with age, maybe resurfacing more vividly or getting triggered by current stressors.
Wow.
You will encounter patients with PTSD in every clinical setting, from maternity to geriatric care and everywhere in between.
That really paints a picture of how widespread and long-lasting it can be.
Yeah.
Now, one of the things people most associate with PTSD is re-experiencing the traumatic event. Can you tell us more about that? It's not just remembering, right?
You're absolutely right. It's far more intense than just remembering. When we talk about re-experiencing in PTSD, we're talking about involuntary, intrusive, often terrifying ways the trauma just violently intrudes on the person's consciousness, pulls them right back into the crisis. This shows up in a couple of key ways. First, recurrent and intrusive dreams, often nightmares that vividly replay parts of the trauma, sometimes night after night. It disrupts sleep, makes real rest impossible.
Horrible.
Imagine waking up drenched in sweat, genuinely believing you're still in that horrifying situation. And even more intense are flashbacks. These aren't just memories. They're deeply immersive dissociative experiences. The individual feels as if the event is happening again right now.
Right now.
Yes. It can involve all the senses, sight, sound, smell, touch, even taste. A veteran might be in a quiet hospital room, but maybe the smell of antiseptic suddenly triggers a flashback to a field hospital, complete with the sounds of screams, the feeling of danger. During a flashback, the person genuinely believes they are literally back in the trauma, losing touch with current reality. It's incredibly distressing, disorienting, and it can lead to defensive or aggressive reactions, even in a perfectly safe place, which for us as nurses is critical to understand for safety and de-escalation. Their brain is literally tricking them into reliving the terror. They react to a perceived threat, not a present one.
That sounds absolutely terrifying, to be just yanked back into that moment without warning. It really highlights why understanding these symptoms is so crucial for nurses, not just for diagnosis, but for truly empathetic and safe care.
Okay, beyond re-experiencing, our sources break PTSD down into four essential symptom clusters. And here's where it gets really interesting, because these clusters help us see the full, multifaceted impact. They're critical for your assessment skills. Let's walk through them. First up, avoidance.
Yes, the avoidance cluster. It's very common, often profoundly debilitating, and a key area for nursing observation. It describes the person's persistent efforts to steer clear of anything that might remind them of the trauma. And this isn't just, you know, casual forgetfulness or a slight preference. It's a deliberate, sometimes unconscious effort to avoid situations, people, thoughts, feelings, even conversations that trigger memories of the event.
Can you give an example? Sure. Let's say someone experienced a severe assault in a public park. For months afterwards, they might find they can't even walk past any park, let alone the specific one. They might meticulously plan routes to avoid certain areas, taking much longer to get places. It's not just a choice. It's this deeply ingrained avoidance that drastically shrinks their world. Or another patient might withdraw socially, avoiding gatherings where they might feel vulnerable or be asked about things. They might actively try to suppress memories, push them down, which ironically often just makes them stronger and more frequent.
Right.
As nurses, we might see this as social isolation, refusal to join activities, a sudden change in routine. This avoidance can lead to major social isolation, problems at work, and really limit their daily life as their world gets smaller and smaller in an attempt to feel safe.
That makes total sense. It's a natural, though maladaptive, way to try and shield yourself from that overwhelming pain. But yeah, it comes at a huge cost.
Yeah.
The second cluster is about negative mood and cognition. How does trauma affect someone's thoughts and emotional world so deeply?
This cluster covers a whole range of deep-seated changes in how someone thinks and feels. It's almost like the trauma itself casts this long shadow over their entire emotional and cognitive landscape. A key symptom here is mood numbing. A diminished ability to experience positive emotions. They might report feeling generally emotionally flat, unresponsive, unable to feel joy, love, happiness like they used to.
Well, like they just feel nothing.
Exactly. They might say, I just don't feel anything anymore, or things that used to make me happy just don't register. It's incredibly isolating, impacts their ability to connect. And alongside this numbing, you often see persistent negative emotional states, chronic fear, overwhelming horror, anger, guilt, or shame. Sometimes about things related to the trauma that were completely outside their control. Cognitively, we see big alterations too. A common one is an inability to recall important aspects of the trauma, sometimes called dissociative amnesia within PTSD. This isn't just forgetting details. It's a significant, often extensive gap in memory around the event. A protective block where the mind just walls off unbearable details. You also see persistent negative beliefs about oneself, others, or the world. Thoughts like, I'm bad, nobody can be trusted, or the world is completely dangerous, I'm always at risk.
Mm.
These core beliefs become the lens they see everything through, making recovery really challenging. And significantly, a profound feeling of detachment or estrangement from others. Feeling isolated, alone, even when surrounded by loved ones, it leads to severe loneliness, depression.
It's so important to recognize.
As nurses, we have to see this as a symptom, not a personal failing or lack of caring.
That sounds incredibly heavy, like the trauma is just soaked into every part of their inner world. Okay, moving to the third cluster, which is critical for us as nurses because of the immediate safety implications, alterations in behavior. What kind of behavioral changes are linked to PTSD?
This cluster is particularly vital for nursing assessments because it often involves actions that can put the individual or others at significant risk. Safety becomes paramount here. We frequently see an increase in aggression and irritability. Small annoyances, minor frustrations can trigger disproportionately angry outbursts. It's not just a bad mood, it's heightened reactivity, often rooted in their hyper-aroused state and perceived threats.
Like snapping easily.
Yes, a patient might snap at staff or family over something minor, seemingly out of the blue. Then there's recklessness. This can show up as impulsive behaviors that put the person in danger. Things like driving dangerously fast, excessive substance abuse, engaging in risky sexual behaviors. These actions are often driven by an underlying hopelessness, a desperate need to feel anything other than that emotional numbness, or maybe even a subconscious self-punishment drive.
Okay, that's serious.
And crucially, this cluster includes self-destructive behaviors. This can range from self-harm, like cutting or burning, to, most concerningly, suicidal ideation. This is why suicide risk assessment is always always the first priority when evaluating someone with PTSD. These behaviors are often desperate cries for help or attempts to gain control over overwhelming emotional pain. They require immediate, decisive nursing intervention.
A powerful reminder of the urgency in our assessments.
Yeah.
You mentioned recklessness. Can you give a specific anonymized example, something a nursing student might realistically see?
Certainly. Let's imagine a patient, call him John. After significant combat trauma, he's struggling back home. He quits a stable job suddenly, starts riding his motorcycle incredibly fast late at night, often without a helmet, begins drinking heavily, which wasn't like him before. If asked, he might just shrug, say, what's the point? Or doesn't matter anyway. He's engaging in these highly dangerous things, maybe not specifically trying to die, but maybe to feel a rush, to numb the constant internal pain, or perhaps unconsciously punish himself. Recognizing that pattern of impulsive, risk-taking behavior, that's a huge red flag. It demands a direct, empathetic conversation about his safety and what's really going on underneath. This cluster really shows why comprehensive safety assessments are key, looking beyond the surface complaint to the motivations behind risky actions.
That example perfectly shows how these concepts translate directly to what we see in the need to act. Okay, finally, the fourth symptom cluster, hyperarousal. This is also an ASD. But how does it show up in chronic PTSD? What are the nuances here?
Hyperarousal in PTSD is this persistent, heightened state of anxiety and reactivity that gets almost hardwired into the person's nervous system. It's like their internal alarm system is constantly scanning for danger, even when there's no objective threat. It shows up in several key ways. First, a really pronounced exaggerated startle response. They jump, flinch, react intensely to sudden noises, unexpected movements, even someone just walking up behind them in a way others wouldn't.
Like reacting to tiny things.
Exactly. Imagine a patient reacting to a dropped pen like it was a gunshot. It's not a choice. It's an involuntary physiological reaction. Second, they often have significant difficulty sleeping, either falling asleep or staying asleep. Their mind races, body's tense, they're constantly vigilant. Restful sleep becomes rare. And this chronic sleep deprivation just makes almost every other symptom worse. It's a vicious cycle.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Third is hypervigilance, constantly on guard, scanning their environment for potential threats. Even in supposedly safe places like home or a hospital room, they might constantly check locks, watch everyone who enters the room, position themselves so they always have an escape route. This constant alertness is incredibly draining, mentally and physically. And finally, similar to the behavioral changes, they can be highly irritable. Small frustrations, minor annoyances, perceived slights can trigger disproportionate anger or agitation. Their emotional regulation system is just overwhelmed. Their fuse is significantly shorter. And to give you that practical example from our sources, connecting it right to assessment, a patient with PTSD startles easily and reacts irritably to small annoyances. The nurse interprets this as which of the following? A, hyperarousal.
Oh, okay.
This directly shows how you'll interpret patient cues in practice, seeing these reactions not as defiance, but as symptoms of a deeply dysregulated nervous system.
That example perfectly nails how these concepts link straight to clinical assessment. It's not just theory, it's what you'll see. What about the course of PTSD? And are there specific risk factors making some people more vulnerable to its long-term effects?
The course of PTSD is rarely straightforward. Symptoms often fluctuate, sometimes dramatically. They frequently get worse during periods of stress, job loss, relationship problems, even physical illness. And sadly, for many, these symptoms can be lifelong, especially, as we mentioned, in older adults carrying trauma memories from earlier life. Recovery is possible, but it's often a long, winding road. There can be periods of remission and relapse.
So it ebbs and flows.
Exactly. As for risk factors, our sources point to a few key things that increase vulnerability. A prior diagnosis of acute stress disorder, ASD, is a big one. It suggests the initial response was severe enough, or perhaps there was a pre-existing sensitivity, making PTSD more likely. The intensity and duration of the trauma itself also play a huge role. More severe, prolonged, or repeated trauma generally raises the risk. Think torture survivors or victims of long-term abuse. They're often at higher risk than someone from a single, less intense event.
Makes sense.
And finally, environmental factors are crucial. Lack of strong social support after the trauma, ongoing stressors, pre-existing mental health issues, a history of prior trauma. All these can contribute to developing PTSD and make it harder to overcome. It's really a mix of individual vulnerability, the trauma's nature, and environmental pressures.
So a complex interplay of factors, internal and external. Mm-hmm. You also mentioned the pathophysiology of ASD with the HPA axis. Does PTSD have an even deeper, more entrenched neurobiological basis explaining why it's so chronic?
It does. It definitely builds on the ASD picture, but often involves more chronic, sometimes even structural, changes in the brain. The neurobiology of the stress response in PTSD is pretty intricate. It involves further, often more entrenched, dysregulation of that HPA axis, leading to a chronically overactive stress response. The body is always primed for threat, flooded with stress hormones. This prolonged state can cause physical health problems and deep mental exhaustion.
Okay, so the HPA axis is still key, but maybe more stuck.
Yes, more stuck, more chronically dysregulated. But beyond the HPA axis, other brain regions are significantly impacted. For instance, the amygdala, the brain's fear center, becomes hyperactive. That leads to the exaggerated startle response, the heightened emotional reactivity. At the same time, the prefrontal cortex, responsible for rational thought, decision-making, emotional regulation, can show decreased activity. This makes it harder for people to logically process their fears or control emotional outbursts.
So, fear center on overdrive, control center underactive.
In simple terms, yes. And the hippocampus, which is crucial for memory formation and retrieval, can actually shrink in volume in people with chronic PTSD. This impacts their ability to properly contextualize traumatic memories or form new ones effectively. It helps explain why intrusive symptoms like flashbacks are so vivid, feel so real, they kind of bypass normal memory processing, staying raw and emotionally charged. And the avoidance and numbing, which can include dissociative symptoms, those are thought to involve complex neurobiological processes aimed at self-protection, essentially shutting down parts of the emotional or cognitive experience to cope with overwhelming distress. It really shows how structurally trauma can alter brain function, cementing these symptoms into deeply ingrained patterns.
That's a truly fascinating, though sobering, look at how the brain tries to cope, sometimes at its own long-term cost. This leads us perfectly into another category of disorders deeply tied to severe trauma, dissociative disorders. How would you introduce dissociation as a concept? It sounds almost like the mind's ultimate escape hatch.
You've hit on a key word there, escape. Dissociation is indeed a fascinating yet concerning coping mechanism. At its core, it's a response to extreme stress or trauma. It involves a kind of splitting or detachment from the self, from reality, or from one's own mental processes, memory, or identity. Think of it as the mind hitting an emergency eject button. It creates psychological distance from an overwhelming experience that it literally cannot process otherwise.
An eject button.
Yeah, it's a protective mechanism. Brilliant in a way, though often maladaptive long term, it allows the person to survive something unbearable, especially when physical escape isn't possible. If your mind can leave your body, or if reality feels like a dream, the trauma feels less immediate, less real, more survivable in that moment. But while it protects in the short term, it creates significant fragmentation later on. Impacts memory, identity, sense of reality, leads to profound distress and dysfunction.
A powerful image splitting of the self to survive. Given that, are there particular groups or experiences where we see more of these dissociative disorders? Where should nurses be especially watchful?
Yes, there's a very strong, well-documented link. Our sources highlight the high prevalence of dissociative disorders among people who experience severe, prolonged childhood physical or sexual abuse. This isn't just a casual connection. It's a profound link between early life trauma, especially chronic, inescapable abuse, and developing these specific coping mechanisms. Dissociation becomes a survival strategy when a child has no other way out.
Okay, so childhood abuse is a major factor.
Huge. And for you as nursing students, this connection really underscores the immense importance of using a trauma-informed approach in all your interactions. It means recognizing that a patient's current presentation, their behavior, emotions, detachment, even memory gaps, might stem from deep-seated early life experiences that force their mind to fragment just to survive. It shifts your view from judging behavior to understanding its roots as a coping mechanism. Leads to more empathetic, effective care.
That's a profound connection. Realizing someone's whole way of being might be shaped by childhood survival strategies. And what about their course? Do these disorders usually pop up suddenly or gradually? Are they always long-term?
The onset can vary quite a bit, which can make them tricky to spot sometimes. It might be sudden, maybe triggered acutely by a current stressor or a memory that brings past trauma flooding back. Or it can happen very gradually over time, almost imperceptibly, as someone develops and relies more on these dissociative strategies to cope with ongoing, overwhelming stress. Similarly, the course can be long-term, lasting years, or even a lifetime, especially if the underlying trauma isn't addressed. But they can also be transient, appearing during acute stress and then resolving as the stress eases or coping improves. This variability requires ongoing assessment and a flexible approach.
Okay, so dissociation itself is a broad spectrum, Can you break down the different types of dissociative disorders we need to know as nurses? What are the key differences?
Certainly. Our sources outline three main types that are important to distinguish. Each represents a different way the mind fragments or detaches. First, there's dissociative amnesia. This is characterized by an inability to recall important yet stressful information, particularly info related to a traumatic event. This isn't just ordinary forgetting, like where you left your keys. It's profound, often selective memory loss, far too extensive to be explained by normal forgetting or a medical condition.
So specific memory gaps.
Yes. The person might forget specific traumatic events or even larger chunks of their life, their personal identity, maybe even skills they knew, with no apparent physical cause. It's like a chapter or even a whole book of their life has just been erased from conscious memory, though the emotional impact often lingers. A nurse might find a patient can't recall details of a recent accident or a period of abuse, which is confusing if you don't understand dissociation.
So their mind blocks out traumatic memories protectively, leaving big gaps. What's the next type?
The second type is depersonalization, derealization disorder. This involves persistent or recurrent feelings of being detached, either from one's own mental processes or body, that's depersonalization, or from one's surroundings, that's derealization. They can happen together or separately, and they create this profound sense of unreality.
Okay, let me see if I get this. Depersonalization. Would that be like watching your own life as a movie, feeling like an outside observer of your own body, maybe feeling like your limbs aren't quite yours?
Exactly. That's a very common description.
And derealization, then, is feeling like the world around you isn't quite real, or it's distorted somehow, fuzzy, dreamlike.
Precisely. You've captured it perfectly with those analogies. Those are often the exact ways patients describe it. Depersonalization is truly that sense of being an outside observer of yourself, thoughts, feelings, body, like you're not fully in your own experience. Patients might say they feel robotic, like they're living in a dream, watching their life from a distance. And derealization is that distinct feeling that your surroundings aren't real, or they're dreamlike, foggy, lifeless, maybe even two-dimensional. The world seems distorted, unfamiliar, emotionally disconnected.
That sounds incredibly unsettling.
It is. Both can be incredibly unsettling, disorienting, profoundly alienating, leads to significant anxiety and distress. Imagine trying to explain that feeling when you're not even sure your own reality is real. As nurses, we must validate these experiences, acknowledge that for the patient, they are absolutely real.
Incredibly disorienting.
Yeah.
And scary, frankly. Okay, finally, the third type, the one many people might know by its former name. Dissociative identity disorder, often portrayed dramatically in movies, but what's the clinical reality?
Yes. The third type is dissociative identity disorder, or DIA, formerly known as multiple personality disorder. It's probably the most complex and widely recognized, though often misunderstood, dissociative disorder. It's characterized by the presence of at least two distinct personality or identity states that recurrently take control of the individual's behavior.
Not just mood swings, then?
Definitely not. It's important to clarify. These aren't just mood swings or different facets of one personality like we might casually use the term. These are truly distinct states, often with their own unique patterns of thinking, feeling, behaving, sometimes even different memories, ages, mannerisms, voices, or even physiological responses.
Wow. Distinct states.
What's happening is a profound fragmentation of identity, a deep splitting of the self that develops as a complex coping mechanism, usually in response to severe, often chronic, early childhood trauma, typically prolonged, inescapable abuse. Each identity state, often called an alter, exists to handle a specific aspect of the trauma or the person's life that the primary or host personality couldn't cope with. The shifts between these identities, the switches, can be sudden and dramatic, often triggered by stress, or they can be subtle. The person may experience significant memory gaps, dissociative amnesia, for times when another identity was in control.
Okay.
For nurses, understanding DID requires immense patience, a non-judgmental approach, recognizing you might be interacting with different aspects of the same person, each with their own needs and perspective. It's about providing consistent, safe care to someone whose internal world is profoundly fractured.
That's a powerful description, highlighting it's far more than mood changes. It's a fundamental, deeply rooted shift in identity born from extreme coping. Now, we've talked definitions, symptoms of these complex disorders, but how common are they, really? What's the true scope of the challenge we, as future healthcare providers, are going to face?
It's important to say, again, like our sources state, not everyone who experiences trauma will be emotionally injured. Human resilience is remarkable. However, for those who are impacted, the numbers are significant. They paint a clear picture of the widespread challenge you will face. When we look at PTSD statistics, for example, the lifetime prevalence in the general population is substantial. About 8% of men and 20% of women will experience PTSD at some point.
1 in 5 women. That's a lot.
Yeah. It's not small figures, no. It means a significant portion of the population carries this burden. But when we look at specific highly exposed groups, the prevalence can just skyrocket. Our sources highlight the varied estimates in veterans returning from combat zones like Iraq and Afghanistan, ranging from 0% up to a staggering 48% in males, and from 2% up to an even higher 68% in women.
68%?
Yeah.
Wow. That range is huge, but the top end is incredible.
It is. That vast range reflects different experiences, roles, support systems. But yeah, the upper ends mean potentially nearly 7 out of 10 female veterans struggling with PTSD.
Those numbers are truly staggering,
okay.
Especially for veterans and active duty folks.
Mm-hmm.
It means as nurses, we will see patients with these disorders, not just in psych units, but everywhere. Primary care, ERs, surgical wards, definitely in geriatric care where old traumas can resurface.
Mm.
This isn't some niche area of nursing. It's fundamental.
Absolutely. And similarly, for dissociative disorders, while exact population-wide numbers are harder to nail down, maybe due to misdiagnosis or underreporting, we strongly reconfirm that high prevalence among people who experience childhood physical or sexual abuse. That strong link means that in any population where childhood trauma is prevalent, which is unfortunately widespread, you'll likely see more of these complex dissociative coping mechanisms. These statistics just underscore. These aren't rare, obscure conditions. They're widespread, impact diverse groups across the lifespan, and demand informed, compassionate, trauma-aware care from every single healthcare professional, starting with you, the nurse. They are not other people's problems. They are our patients' realities.
Okay. We've gone deep into definitions, symptoms, prevalence, but now the absolute core of what you need to know as nursing students. So what does all this mean for you as a nurse on the front lines? How do we translate this understanding of ASD, PTSD, dissociative disorders into practical, effective, truly safe care? What are the priority nursing assessments and interventions we absolutely have to master?
This really is the most critical section for you because it directly informs your daily practice. It can literally be life-saving. When a client is experiencing a trauma or stress-related disorder, our priorities in nursing assessment are paramount. They guide everything that comes next. The first, and always, always the most crucial priority, assess for suicidal ideations. This is non-negotiable.
Always first.
Always. Trauma, especially chronic PTSD and dissociative disorders, carries a very high risk of self-harm. You must directly, empathetically ask about thoughts of harming oneself. Ask about plans. Ask about access to means. Ensuring the client's immediate safety from self-harm comes before anything else can be effectively done. You can't address their trauma if their life is at immediate risk. Step one. Always. And it's ongoing, not a one-time check.
Okay. Safety first, suicidal ideation assessment. What's next?
Second, as needed, we must assess for homicidal precautions. Now, this is less common than suicidal ideation, but some clients, particularly those with severe hyperarousal, anger, or maybe feeling a need for extreme self-protection, might express thoughts of harming others. Assessing for any potential risk of harm to others is also a critical safety measure. Ensure safety for the client, other patients, staff. Again, direct questioning is essential. If a risk is found, immediate action is needed to keep everyone safe.
Right. Safety for everyone involved makes sense. And the third priority.
Third, and foundational for building trust and giving truly effective care, is active listening. And I mean active. This isn't just hearing words. It's deeply listening to their narrative, paying close attention to verbal and nonverbal cues to identify the client's most troubling aspects of their experience.
What's bothering them the most right now?
Exactly. Is it the nightmares, the flashbacks, that feeling of detachment, the constant anxiety? This information is gold. It guides individualized care, helps you prioritize specific symptoms, and starts building that therapeutic relationship based on trust and understanding. Without knowing what troubles them most, our interventions could be way off base or feel irrelevant to them. It's about meeting them where they are.
So safety first, always. Then really engaging, listening empathetically to understand their experience, what's most pressing for them. And it sounds like these assessments aren't just checkboxes either, but ongoing, right? Mm-hmm. Given how these things fluctuate.
Precisely. They're dynamic, continuous processes. They evolve as the client's condition, their trust level, their immediate stressors change. Now, moving from assessment to action, let's talk about the nursing interventions that flow logically, critically from these priorities. First, straight from our assessment, safety. Implement suicidal and homicidal precautions as needed. This isn't just a thought, it means concrete actions. Maybe placing the client on constant observation, removing dangerous objects, ensuring they're never alone, involving security or psych emergency services, initiating a formal suicide prevention protocol. It's a direct, immediate, paramount response to our priority assessments, safeguarding the client and others.
Okay, direct action based on the safety assessment. Got it.
Second, and vital for clients with hyperarousal, hypervigilance, or who startle easily, consistently provide a non-threatening environment. This means being super mindful of your approach. Use a calm, soft voice. Approach slowly from the front where they can see you, not from behind. Explain every procedure clearly, simply, before you touch them or do anything.
Respect their space too, I imagine.
Absolutely. Respect their personal space, which might be much larger than average. Ensure the physical environment is as calm, predictable, quiet as possible. Reduce sensory overload. A safe space reduces triggers, minimizes that hyperarousal activation, and crucially, promotes the trust needed for any therapy to happen.
It makes perfect sense. Calm, predictable, respectful. What's third?
Third, reinforcing that power of active listening is validation. We actively listen to identify the most troubling aspects, and then we validate their experience. This is incredibly powerful. It means letting them know you hear them, you believe them, you understand that what they went through was real, profoundly impactful, that their feelings, their reactions are understandable given what happened.
So saying things like?
Phrases like, it sounds like what you went through was truly terrifying, or it's completely understandable that you're feeling this way, can make an enormous difference. Validation isn't agreeing with harmful behavior, it's acknowledging their subjective experience. It helps them feel seen, understood, less alone, a vital step in healing.
Seen and understood.
Oh.
Okay, fourth.
Fourth. To promote agency and fight those pervasive feelings of helplessness that often come with trauma, assist the client to identify past successes to promote their ability to regain control. This is about actively tapping into their inherent resilience. When clients feel overwhelmed, helpless, like they have no control over their minds or lives, gently reminding them of times they have overcome challenges or skills they used successfully before, that helps them recognize their own strengths. Their capabilities.
Building on what they already have.
Exactly. It empowers them to apply those existing strengths to their current overwhelming situation. Fosters a sense of self-efficacy, control, which is incredibly therapeutic. You might ask, you mentioned you managed to get through past difficulty. What strategies did you use then that might help now?
I like that. Focusing on their strengths. Mm. And finally,
it's absolutely crucial to emphasize that various types of therapy and support are needed for comprehensive, holistic care. Our role as VRSAs often involves facilitating access to these, supporting engagement, and providing direct care within them. This includes evidence-based therapies like cognitive behavioral therapy, CBT, helps identify and reframe negative thought patterns, behaviors from trauma. Exposure therapy, a specialized CBT, helps people gradually confront traumatic memories or situations safely, reducing their power. Eye movement desensitization and reprocessing, EMDR, is another highly effective therapy.
So specific therapies are key.
Yes. But also, group or family therapy can provide invaluable social support, reduce isolation, help mend relationships. And beyond formal therapy, vital parts of a holistic plan include building strong social support networks, making healthy lifestyle changes like exercise, diet, practicing mindfulness and stress management to regulate the nervous system, using relaxation techniques like deep breathing or progressive muscle relaxation. It highlights that recovery is multifaceted. It almost always involves a multidisciplinary team, nurses, doctors, therapists, social workers. And your role as a nurse is central to coordinating, supporting, and directly providing a big part of that comprehensive journey.
This has been such an illuminating and incredibly practical deep dive. What's truly fascinating is just how interconnected these concepts are. How trauma can show up acutely as ASD, then potentially linger and deepen into PTSD, or create that profound detachment and fragmentation through dissociative disorders. And critically, how our role as nurses, starting with those immediate unwavering safety assessments, then moving to empathetic, validating, empowering interventions, is absolutely foundational, guiding our patients toward healing and recovery.
Indeed. It's a profound reminder that beneath every diagnosis, there's a complex human story. Often shaped by unseen experiences, silent battles. For you, as you step into your nursing careers, your understanding of these disorders, it will profoundly shape your approach. To every single patient, whether they explicitly share their trauma or not, you now have a robust framework to recognize the unseen battles being fought inside, to interpret behaviors as symptoms, not character flaws, and to respond with knowledge and genuine compassion. As you move forward, maybe consider this. How will your deeper understanding of trauma and these stress-related disorders inform every interaction, every assessment, every act of care? Knowing that for many, the hardest battles are often fought entirely within themselves, demanding our most informed and empathetic presence.
A powerful and essential question to carry with you throughout your career. We really hope this deep dive encourages you to reflect on how you can be an unwavering advocate for trauma-informed care everywhere you practice, bringing both your hard-earned knowledge and your profound compassion to those who need it most. Thank you for joining us on the Deep Dive.